we were invited to attend a 9-week summer program at the Aspen Music Festival. And this is the Aspen that people don't know because now it's like a hot spot.
Right.
It wasn't really that way when I was there, where I was exposed to like some of the best musicians in the world. And I then began to realize, wow, that is what amazing looks like. I knew what good looked like, but I didn't realize what great looked like. And then I found something to aspire to. And that actually allowed me to dream and really reach for something bigger than myself.
Welcome to the My Fourth Act podcast. I'm your host, Achim Novak, and I have conversations with exceptional humans who have created bold and unexpected lives. If you like what you hear, please subscribe on any major podcast platform so you won't miss a single one of my inspiring guests. And please consider posting an appreciative review. Let's get started. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Grace Neva to the My Fourth Act podcast. Grace's professional journey in life has been deliciously non-linear. Grace started as a piano prodigy who earned a master's degree in piano performance at Juilliard. She had her own public relations, marketing, and event management firm for over a decade. A subsequent career in executive search led to increasingly prominent roles at pharma powerhouses Biogen and Flagship Pioneering. These days, Grace is the VP of Global Talent Acquisition, Talent Intelligence, and a few other things at the red-hot Vertex Pharmaceuticals. I think of Grace as an innovator and disruptor in a very competitive industry. Hello, Grace.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well.
So nice to see you.
I just want to ask this question because I'm a public figure and people sometimes introduce me and then go, gosh, is that really me? So what was it like to hear this introduction?
I loved it. Thank you. It's always nice. You know, sometimes you're so busy working, you forget. No, you're right. It was a journey. And also, thank you so much for being inviting me to be part of your podcast. I really appreciate that. Very honored.
With every guest, I like to start by finding out just when you were a young girl or teenager, you know how parents usually have ambitions for us or they want us to figure out what we're going to do. What were you thinking of?
Well, so just give you a little bit of background. Growing up in an immigrant family in Toronto, I was thinking about this last night. My dreams and aspirations were limited because my world was smaller, right? Mm-hmm. But I did start playing the piano at age 4, and my mother was very focused on that, on making me and my sister serious musicians. That was her dream. In Toronto, the classical music community was good, but I don't think until I got to the U.S., where we were invited to attend a 9-week summer program mm-hmm. at the Aspen Music Festival. And this is the Aspen that people don't know because now it's like a hot spot.
Right.
It wasn't really that way when I was there, where I was exposed to like some of the best musicians in the world. I then began to realize, wow, that is what amazing looks like. I knew what good looked like, but I didn't realize what great looked like. Then I found something to aspire to, and that actually allowed me to dream and really reach for something bigger than myself.
I love your delineation between good and amazing. I also have a lot of friends in dance and other artistic disciplines. And I know that getting to amazing takes a lot of work, right? Could you just talk about the discipline that was required to aim for that level of ability and competence?
So thank you for asking that question. I think some people don't realize how much work it takes, especially as a young child, right? So at age 12, I realized that I needed to make a decision whether this was something I wanted to do or whether it was something I was doing for my parents, because it was so intertwined and it was making me unhappy. And my mother, you know, she was that tiger mom, right? She sat next to me for hours at a time, making sure I was practicing daily. And so that can be real, you know, you're thinking to yourself, do I you want to have this kind of relationship with your mother? That early realization at age 12 was very vivid in my mind that I made a decision that this is something I'm going to go for, and that what is that going to take? And that takes a lot of dedication of practicing, sacrificing, maybe sometimes having friends, sacrificing social parts of your life when you're that young, that was something that my family, as well as myself, decided we were going to do. We were going to commit ourselves to this. Frankly, if we hadn't done that, I don't think I would have been able to get that far, right? That early decision had to be something that I had to commit to, then also invest in, and understanding that I'm not going to get some of the other things because I've decided to do this. So it's hours. So when you say hours, how many hours do you practice? I practice like 8 hours a day, sometimes 10. Then I would start my homework, right? That dedication of really building that framework of, okay, when you're young, you got to spend the time practicing because you're not going to be able to do it later. So you actually need to work on the techniques. You got to work on certain kinds of composers earlier on in life. It's harder to learn some of those things later on. So that was how I spent my, you know, growing up, is a lot of his music. There was one time I was at a hotel and I heard a violin. And I'm like, that's probably my family, right? Thinking, okay, you're on vacation, but you still have to practice. So that discipline, there was no break. Again, that's an adult type of thing to practice, be dedicated. So it's like, I would say, what athletes go through. For them to be able to be competitive, this is a daily thing for them.
Now, you went to the very prestigious Juilliard School. You finished your studies there. And then at some point, you decided to not pursue a commercial / professional career, which in music, which can mean different things. So I'm curious as tech about how you made that decision.
I didn't make it for a while. So I graduated and then I did my Carnegie Hall debut. And I think once I finished that, I thought to myself, you know, I'm very pragmatic as well. So let's say, you know, 1% of the world gets a Juilliard school. And then a part of that 1%, very few of us actually have like concert careers. And then even less pianists don't have those types of careers either. So the option is to go either do my PhD, then end up maybe in a very small college somewhere in the middle of nowhere. That did not appeal to me. I was thinking, what's my other option? What was my fourth option? I taught for a while, and again, I saw the writing on the wall. I thought, you know what, if I'm not obsessed with my instrument, that I want to actually be in a small town college teaching and being that professor, I probably need to figure out how to transfer whatever skills I have to something else. So that was my journey in figuring out how to do that. It was painful. It was actually a real painful process. But in the middle of it, my sister also was a very, very talented violinist. And she was going through what we thought was a nervous breakdown, but actually turned out that she was diagnosed as schizophrenic. That was another reason why I thought, okay, now I really need to figure out how to make a living. It's making music right now. There's a window into how much I can make. I already did the math and I thought I really have to figure out what my next phase of life, I have to reinvent myself and figure out what my next phase of life is going to be.
You know what really strikes me, and we're going to jump around a little bit because you've done a lot of things, but if we fast forward to your period where you did your own public relations marketing, event management, what really strikes me as we're talking, I think of piano studying, all that work, as solitary, or it's solitary with one or two major teachers, and then you work something that's an incredibly public, constant engagement with people, which in my mind taps into a totally different part of Grace. Could you just talk about what it was like to be in that part of your world?
Sure. Right? Yes. Again, discovering what can I do? I have understand the classical music world. I have the connections there of friends who also were doing that. And during that time of transition, I was introduced to a man named Charlie Hamlin, and who was actually an IMG artist agent who left because his partner died of AIDS. And he founded an organization called Classical Action. Classical Action was a nonprofit that raised money for AIDS. And he brought in, again, he was like that person who had, you know, all the famous artists that he managed. He brought that group of people together to raise money. And I thought, well, I can do that too, I thought. You know, I have the network. Why didn't I do something, but from my community standpoint? So at that point, there was actually a famine of North Korea where, you know, they were having a hard time getting food. And you would see these pictures of children who were actually 12, but they looked like they were 5, right? Because they were so malnourished. You know, I'm not North Korean, but I am Korean. That spoke to me. So I started the idea of bringing together my friends that I knew that were artists and that were traveling. And then with the help of Mercy Corps, another type of a signal to me, the universe actually introduced me to somebody who was looking for a platform to raise money. So we both of us produced a concert that raised $100,000. And one of the companies I went to was Anheuser-Busch. And I said, you know, I would love to have $2,000 and some beer for the after party. And that guy gave me a contract after that fundraiser. And that lasted 13 years. That's how I started my company.
That's such a beautiful story. It matches many other stories, which is there was a door to moving into what I was in adjacency, and you saw the door and you walked through it. Then the universe did the rest for you, right? Which
exactly.
is really nice.
Yeah.
When you think of that period, I'm always curious because they're, to an outsider, that can sound very glamorous, right? But if you think about what's the highlight from those 13 years where you go, wow, this is why I kept doing it. I loved it. But also, we all have those moments where you go, please get me out of here. I don't want to do this anymore, right? Can you give us a story for each of those?
Yes. Going into an industry, I didn't really, for me, nothing's as scary as playing an instrument in front of thousands of people, and you're the only one on stage, and you're playing for like an hour and a half. That, you have to be really courageous to be able to think, why would anybody buy tickets? Come see me. That is the scariest thing that you can do. So everything else is relatively not as scary. And so I think that created a lot of courage in me because I was already at, I felt ground zero. No, who was going to find me a job when I had no skills? So I had to create my own job. I think that that was a part of, okay, someone's giving me an opportunity. I think I know how to do this. I'm using my own logic, but also my learning that I had promoting concerts or, you know, there was like a transference of skills and also knowledge and being able to bring people together for something and utilize that. And then the other thing I did was I made sure I had people around me who already done that, who are mentors. So I found I was very proactive in seeking out mentors so that if I ever had a question, I knew someone I could call. My instincts were there, but I also had to validate that with others, right, that had been doing it because I really was very inexperienced in many different ways. Figuring it out every day, getting comfortable with discomfort. And then after 13 years of it, I thought doing the same thing over and over again, I think I now know. So I did my 10,000 hours, right? This is the whole thing about the practicing. Did my 10,000 hours, felt like, okay, I know this. I've now known for this, but now I'm bored. So what do I do? And again, my mentor came through. That is part of, for me, that's always been my transference is people have been able to give me opportunities that probably didn't have to. But all those people also came from that nonprofit fundraiser, by the way.
Yeah.
But I've been, I think, reaping benefit from that because I did that for nothing. Nobody paid me. That truly came from my heart. I think I still reap, even for today, I would say I still reap benefits from that experience.
Oh, there's so much wisdom in everything you just said. But the part where I want to drill down some more, because I think it's the crucial part for all of us when we get to the point where we say, I've done what I'm doing for too long. It's safe, but something inside of me is dying. I need to get out of here.
Mm-hmm.
How do you experience that? Like, how does Grace experience like, gosh, I'm very good at this, but, and they keep wanting me to do the same thing, but I'm done with it. Like, walk us a little more into that experience where you have to do something.
Just being comfortable is actually very uncomfortable for me. I don't have that. I guess I'm looking for a little bit of excitement, anxiety of like, maybe I don't know how to do that thing, or I need to be a little scared. The challenge has to be bigger than myself for me to really dig in. And when that goes away, then I know that I need to start looking for something that scares me. That's to me my barometer on making sure that, well, I wouldn't have taken this current job if I didn't feel scared.
Yeah.
There had to be something that gave me a little bit of the butterflies and enough of a stretch for me to say, okay, here is something I can like dive into and learn and develop. When that goes away is when I have to either start challenging myself and finding other areas of what I'm doing bringing other ideas and other types of people that can actually, who are smarter than me, that I can learn from. And so that's the part of constantly the curiosity, making sure that you're keeping that steady.
So you're currently at Vertex. You've been there for a while. You've proven yourself.
For 3 years.
But let's get rid of that moment that you just mentioned to you. You've been at Biogen. You've been at Flagship Pioneering. Those are two very different but highly respected entities in the pharma world. What was the thing that maybe had the good scariness about Vertex, where going in, what was the part that go, oh, shoot, I haven't done this before. I have to learn this. This is a stretch.
So at Biogen, I was a sole contributor. I wasn't managing any team, but I was a specialist. Being able to find VPs and above at Biogen and also do succession planning. So I literally was talking to a ton of people for potential and networking. So that then carried me over to Flagship. Now, Flagship was supposed to be the same job, frankly, as the Biogen job.
Right.
But they changed the job on me when I got there because the business was changing. There was under 100 people there at the mothership, mm-hmm. right? That were just investing in building. That's a totally different number now. At that point, I was one of the very few that was part of building that infrastructure. I just said yes. I didn't know anything about talent acquisition. I figured it out. I understood, like, it's not rocket science. But what I loved about being at Flagship was that they're all about 10x thinking. They're all about doing things that nobody's ever done before. So I had the freedom to think very differently. And that was a huge area of learning, and you're leapfrogging because you're experimenting. And so that's sort of been my learning, is that, oh, I don't know that yet. I don't know what's going to happen, but let's just try it. Let's do an experiment. Do like doing a pre-series A where you only have 3 to 5 people doing that. And until then, if the science works, you go to the next level. It's the same thing with ideation. And so part of it was taking that way of thinking about science and then applying it to acquisition. That's where I think I really learned so much more about what I could do to push the envelope. And I really, that is something that I carry with me from that experience, is so valuable. It beats to, again, that area of wanting to stretch, wanting to push the envelope, wanting to see where we can take it to make impact. Because at the end of the day, it's about the patient. If we can get the right people to the company at the right time, that can really move the needle for the company. That to me is like true happiness, really, from a professional standpoint.
Let's dive into Vertex a little bit, which is I call it a red hot company in pharma. It is. There's amazing stuff going on. But I think I properly labeled you in my introduction as an innovator and disruptor. Those are both positives in your vision for talent management, talent acquisition, what it can do. And most of our listeners won't know anything about talent management in your world. But if you would do like an executive summary, what does being innovator and disruptor in that very important professional playground, what does that look like for you?
Right. So for me, the magic sauce of talent acquisition, what I'm doing, is around finding the right people. And how do you know they're right? It's all about attracting people, but also knowing where they live and where they want. So where is the supply and demand of this talent? A lot of what Vertex does is requires niche talent and niche skills. They're not people that you're just going to find off the street. A lot of them already have jobs. Then what is the, you know, the value proposition? What is the story? So I think an internal talent team can actually be a very powerful voice for a company like Vertex, where we know the culture, we know the company, we know the science, and we're able to have very evolved conversations with talent. Because if somebody calls you and they already know your world, then you're having a different conversation versus someone who's just talking to you about a rec or a job description, a job posting. That's different. And it's also different when someone's available, right? A talent who's available versus talent who is already engaged because they're one of the top talents. What kind of conversation are you going to have with that person? It's a very different conversation. So what I'm trying to do with my team is build intelligence function that helps you gather that information so that you can figure out what the message is going to be to attract that top talent to come to Vertex. That requires insights understanding their world, understanding why they would want to stay there, and then also maybe understanding why they might want to leave and have a conversation with you. So that requires a lot more investigation and a lot more insights about competitors. And so you're not going in having a basic conversation. You're going in already having a conversation where that person thinks they know you because you've actually, you know, their publications. They know the recruiter is really coming to you in a different type of way that differentiates you from other recruiters that might be calling you. That's really the training that I'm trying to provide the talent acquisition. And it can be game changing in certain areas and functions of the business. Even though it's been 3 years, it's still developing because you're also educating the hiring managers and how we work and that it might be different for them because everyone we're bringing in, if you look at the company, majority of them are new now, right? Because we're growing. And so it's constant education, constant partnership. I'm really coming from the business and understanding where the business is going so that we are able to figure out how we help these hiring managers make the best decisions for the business.
What really strikes me as I'm listening to you is that this is talent recruitment beyond just getting 20 resumes that match the job description. Yeah. Because you can find resumes that match the job description. But yeah. I heard investigation, I heard talent intelligence. It's very delicious what you all are doing. I want to go back to the word you used at the beginning of the interview, which is going from good to amazing. Your own standards, I have a feeling, have remained to be amazing consistently. My feeling is that people who are amazing themselves will go, gosh, I want to work with Amazing Grace. You're part of the pun. But some people might go, gosh, I can't keep up with her. She's three steps ahead of me. You know, like when my Juilliard, you said, is the top 1%, if we transfer this to top 1% of your current industry, and some people go, oh, I want to play there. And some people might go, oh, no, I want to keep doing what I'm doing. How do you navigate the complexities of being an innovator? Yeah.
So you have to meet people where they're at, right? I think I'm optimistic in trying to convert people. It's like a win if one person is converted and one person says, oh my gosh, I didn't realize it could be this way.
Yeah,
it's a different expense. That to me is gold. And it takes a while, actually naturally impatient. But when it comes to this, the realization that people have, why do I care that it gets to this place? I think I'm all about mastering something. I'm mastering a skill, mastering an area, doing my 10,000 hours. In some areas, I still am doing those 10,000 hours. And that gives you that deep insight because you've spent the time there. You know inside you've spent that those hours, you've invested in those hours. If you don't invest in those hours, you can't feel that conviction, I feel. Part of it is if I want people to trust me and also follow me in what my beliefs are, how I approach talent, I feel like I need to do that work. Be able to try to get people to start getting mature and experience things here and there. And then they buy in because people are smart. Like they're like, oh, I get it now, you know, and they figure out. And not everybody is going to be this way. There is time to be transactional, okay? There are times where we just hit the ground running and there are other times where we have to sit back and be more strategic. And so we just need to figure out when to do what. So I'm not married to everybody has to be this way, but there is a place and there are certain roles where you should. And then there are other roles where I'm like, you know, you just go. So there's a flexibility that's needed, but there should be a place for everybody in how they work here. But understanding and respecting that this is the approach that, frankly, in the future is going to be even more important because of technology, because there's going to be times when humans are going to play more of a part in this. Because there are things that the machine's going to be able to do now that you don't have to do anymore. So a lot of your time is shifted away from the administrative piece. And now it's actually going to be shifted more into the people piece where you really need to know the talent. I think actually the way that I'm thinking it's going to work because of the future piece, the training of talent acquisition now, I think that role is changing to be more that data analyst, that marketeer, that the talent intelligence piece. Like you have to be that researcher. All those aspects of recruiting is now essential to be successful because technology is over. Yeah.
What really struck me in what you said, and because I believe this, but not everybody mm-hmm. articulates it as well as you just did. Yeah. So I'm going to paraphrase this. What I heard is the more we can use AI and all those wonderful tools, the more important the human part becomes, right? Rather than obsolete. We need to do that better. You know, we need to do that better. As somebody who, you've been very intentional, but what I also heard, there have been lots of organic evolutions as you move into different steps of your career. As you think of the future, are there things lurking in the back of your mind? You go, gosh, I've always wanted to do this. Or if I had time to do that, that would be amazing. Are there any other secret dreams and aspirations?
Always. I think it depends on where you are in your life, right? I have now a son who's going to go to college. I have one who's going into high school. I feel that right now is not the time to create stability for the family. So I feel very lucky. I have a job where I feel very fulfilled. But then once my kids are, all of them are like out of college or both in college, then I'll have more time to have that freedom to be able to, hey, maybe, you know, I'm going to go to the Culinary Institute of America and become a chef like I've always wanted to. Maybe I'll try improv. You know, maybe I'll do some of these things that I haven't really been able to invest in. Maybe I'll start playing the piano again. There are so many things I'd love to do, but there's a practical side of me too, that regardless of all of this, there's something that grounds me. And I think that also comes from being a musician, seeing zero in my bank account. There are times where I'm like a little bit like going back to that day, right? I don't want to be there ever again. And so that keeps me steady.
I want to ask you, I call this the professional ambition question, because I coach a lot of people at your level of career, VPs, senior VP, hugely accomplished. And in my experience, once we cross a certain age threshold, then the question is, how important is it to get another bigger opportunity, a bigger title versus let me do a good job where I am? Some people go, let me find a smaller playground where I can maybe even make more mischief. Like, how do you navigate those questions, which are typical for somebody at your career?
I'm more role, the interesting role, the interesting people, the culture. That's the kind of place where I'm going to thrive. But that's more important to me. That is who I'm going to work with. Am I going to thrive there? Am I going to learn? It's not really the title or the company or what have you. You know, here I have all of that. The Vertex, I have all of that right now. So that is ultimately what you want. I also am realistic. Like, not everybody can have that at every job that they have. That's the other piece. I'm very grateful right now because I feel like this is like the sweet spot. And it can change within. And it should change. Because companies change, people come and go and things like this. And so you have to adjust constantly. But a lot of it is, for me, it's driven by people and the kind of people I want to be around, and that also value and see me and understand where I can be leveraged. Because there are times when you're in situations where people don't see you. That can be very disheartening for someone like me. That is really what I'm led by.
We could have a whole our conversation about we just
you probably could
here. That was the door, and I'm just thinking, do I want to walk through that one or not? But let me take us down this path, because I was thinking about this as you're talking to, and if we can go back to maybe you, to your Korean American immigrant background. I was born in Germany. I'm German born, came here as a teenager. So the two things I've heard my entire life, either gosh, you seem so German, or you don't seem German at all. Both are loaded statements, right? But obviously, what they make me think about is, to what degree am I a part of the German culture? To what degree am I not? In your case, how does your Korean family immigrant background still influence you? And are there things that you had to maybe consciously put aside so they weren't such a big part of your life?
It's a loaded question. because it's so layered. Just to answer it simply, it has a lot to do with, so when immigrants, they take with them what they know of Korea or that country. And even though that country has changed, to them, it's still that, the same. when my parents went back to Korea a couple years ago, they said, oh, it's so different. I'm like, of course it is. The thing is, the way that you remember is the way that you've raised the family. So when you're in a kind of a 1.5 generation type of situation where you're, you know, I was one when they immigrated to Toronto. And so I had one foot in the Western world trying to assimilate. And then when I was home and in a different world. And so sometimes I felt like two people. Part of that was trying to figure out who was I? How do I find my self-worth? Because most immigrants don't have confidence because of the language. They're trying to figure out how they fit into this new society that they, you know, where they don't have that comfort. It was a real journey to get to where I am today. It took a lot of work, actually. And so part of it is I'm so grateful for it because actually now I'm a leader where I'm more interested in my direct success than my own because I've done that work. I'm not yearning right now to figure out what my next role is or what have you. I'm more interested in the experiences and the kinds of people I want to be around. But it took a long time to get to this place. And I think it has to do with really acceptance of yourself, your self-worth, where you're finding your self-worth, what you care about, what you are also know about yourself that's not so great. And there are a lot of areas of my growing up experience that is not always the healthiest of thinking because immigrants have their way of thinking about what looks good. It may not be very healthy. That was a journey as well to say, you know what, that may be the way that they think is healthy, but to me, actually, it's been damaging. You know, working around and sort of putting that where it is in its place, and then still feeling like, okay, but I'm still proud of me. I'm still advocating for myself because nobody else was. And so those are the kinds of lessons I think I've learned. And I'm grateful for all of those lessons because I don't think I could be where I am right now if I didn't have that. It's a different outlook and it adds to the layer. Like the fact that I grew up and every morning I had to understand what mood my mother was in. Frankly, that experience allowed me to be more intuitive about people and my environment. So that training was actually very valuable for me. I didn't realize that until later. I'm like, why am I so like tuned into everything right now? It's because I grew up like that.
I appreciate how you said all that and but I also want to really extrapolate. It took some work to figure all that out. And so I applaud you. Final question, and it builds on what we just said. If from your current vantage point, you could offer some wisdom and guidance to young Grace, almost like you're the fairy godmother, not to change her journey in life, because I think everything unfolds as it's supposed to, but what would you want her to know about life that she couldn't have known back then?
Don't worry so much. It always works out and have faith in the universe, bring you what you need at the right time. Because then I wouldn't have been so anxious. I always felt like I had somebody chasing after me, I think. And once I realized that it always worked out anyway, so maybe I don't have to be so nervous about what's going to happen in the future because it wasn't something I could like anchor myself on, right? Like when you have foundation, you can bounce back up from it. So when you don't have that foundation, which was what I was like when I was younger, I couldn't bounce. I just had to start over again. And so now I have that foundation where if something does happen, I am able to then get myself back up again and build that. But that takes a lot of help from lots of different people. It's not something that just happens. It's through the love of friends and family and all sorts of people that help you along the way. So I'm also a person who's 100% about paying it forward. That's huge for me. And I will spend the time to do that because others have done that for me.
Beautiful. I know you work for a big entity, Vertex. You don't have your own business or company, but if you'd like people to learn more about Vertex and what you all do, because it's an amazing company, where should people go to find out the impact that you personally have in that playground?
Well, they should go to our website or our LinkedIn company page and get to know us better or reach out to me. I'm happy to speak to anybody about Vertex. I think it's a fantastic company. If you are passionate about what you do, you want to do it better, and you want to go deep, this is a place for you to go. We will challenge you. It's an intense place. It is something where you have to be an expert in what you do. I think that is not for everybody, but if you thrive in controlled chaos, One of them are fast, very patient driven. This is a fantastic place to be. You're going to learn a ton. It's not about swimming in your own swim lanes. It's about actually being in the whole pool together as a company. It's team oriented and it's very collaborative. So if that's the way you like to work, you're going to love it here.
Thank you, Grace, for the gift of this conversation. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the My Fourth Act podcast. If you like what you have heard, please like us and leave a review on your preferred podcast platform. And if you would like to engage more deeply in Fourth Act conversations, check out the Mastermind page at achimnovak.com. It's where Fourth Actors like you engage in riveting conversation with other Fourth Actors. See you there, and bye for now.